Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens when a quest for glory and scientific achievement turns into a struggle just to stay alive in the most forbidding climate on Earth? The North Pole was one of the last remaining frontiers to be explored. In the late 19th century, so little was known about it that many people believed speculation that it might contain a warm, open sea or even a passage to the center of the Earth. In the hopes that America could be the first nation to successfully send a crew there and back, an eccentric publishing magnate agreed to bankroll an attempt by a young naval commander whose crew of 32 men endured hardships beyond their worst nightmares. Author Hampton Sides details the adventure in his new book, In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. He's in town to speak tonight to the Highland Park United Methodist Church Authors Live event. Hampton, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be back with you.
All right, so tell us, what were the prevailing ideas about the North Pole in the 1870s?
Yeah, when I did this book, I kind of had to scrape away all the things that I know to be up there and try to put myself in that period, because there were a lot of crazy notions. Some of them went back to the Greeks and the Vikings, notions of Hyperborea or Ultima Thule, some sort of warm place beyond the mountains, beyond the ice, if we could just somehow reach it. But the prevailing theory that I focus on in the book is this open polar sea theory that you alluded to. A number of scientists believed in it. We were just discovering the power of the Gulf Stream and how much it is bringing up from the tropics, and this great curiosity about where it led. We knew it went north past Norway somewhere, so the theory began that perhaps it tunnels under the ice and goes to the North Pole, and that's where the open polar sea comes from. It's almost like trying to prove the existence of God or something with elaborate arguments, like, well, we're going to argue that this thing exists, even though no one has seen it. No one has actually witnessed this open polar sea. We did discover that there was another current in the Pacific Ocean that did very much the same thing and seemed to go north through the Bering Strait. So the theory was these two great currents of the world brought heat from the tropics to the north, and tunneled under the ice, and created the sea up there. So the Jeannette expedition, the subject of my book, was a expedition designed expressly to test that theory. And unfortunately, with these Arctic tales, often men have to suffer unimaginable hardship and sometimes die in order to prove or disprove these kinds of theories.
Big adventures sold newspapers then, as I suppose big adventures draw people to the television set today. And so it was not such a crazy thing for a newspaper man to try to make one of these things happen. Tell us about James Gordon Bennett.
Well, James Gordon Bennett is just one of these outlandish Gilded Age characters that you dream about if you're a narrative historian like me.
Excuse me for interrupting. If you'd written a novel, I would have said he's too far-fetched.
Yeah, I know. He was the third richest man in Manhattan. He had inherited this newspaper from his dad. It was the largest newspaper in the world. He was this sort of reckless yachtsman. He won the first transatlantic yacht race, the youngest ever commodore of the New York Yacht Club. He was a duelist. He was a bachelor almost his entire life and squired about women about the world on his various yachts. He ran the paper mainly from Paris via the transatlantic cables, and he was really interested in spectacle and sports and adventure. He brought tennis to the United States. He brought polo to the United States. He got into international balloon racing, but he also was interested in exploration, and he had sent Stanley to Africa to find Livingston, even though Livingston wasn't exactly lost, and these dispatches that Stanley wrote were a sensation and sold tons and tons of newspapers. So Bennett began to think about an encore to Stanley Livingston. What would it be? And, of course, the North Pole was an obsession that the world was fascinated by, and all the different nations, especially the European nations, were locked in competition trying to be the first nation to reach the North Pole. So he knew this would be a huge thing if he could underwrite an expedition to the North Pole and get the Navy involved as well. So that's what happened.
Meanwhile, there is this quite young Navy commander who had had some experience in very cold waters and had found himself really in love with sailing in those conditions.
Yeah, I guess you'd say the hero of the story is Captain George Washington DeLong, who I'm sure if you polled 100 people, have you ever heard of the Jeannette expedition or heard of DeLong? They'd say no. He for a variety of reasons, this story has sort of slipped between the cracks of history, and yet, in its day, it was extremely well known. These guys were like astronauts. There were 20,000 people gathered on the bay in San Francisco to see them off on their voyage, and DeLong was the center of everyone's attention. DeLong had been to Greenland, had fallen in love during an earlier expedition with the Arctic, with the weird atmospheric phenomena, what sounds do, the grandeur of this huge wilderness, and the huge puzzle that was the North Pole. Just people had to know what was up there. People would say things like, you know, a man has to know what his own attic looks like. And this was also part of, during the Gilded Age, we were finally emerging from the devastation of the Civil War and beginning to kind of flex our muscles on the world stage, trying to do something big and to compete with the European powers. Because up to this point, mainly the British had been the leaders of polar exploration. So this was one way to do it. And funded by this eccentric newspaper publisher, but flying under Navy rules with Navy officers and scientists on board, they set sail from San Francisco in the summer of 1879, heading for the Bering Strait and points north.
So George Washington DeLong is such a great name for an explorer. It's notable that he chose that name for himself.
His actual name was George Francis DeLong, but I think sometime in his maybe early teens, he decided that was too wimpy a name for the kinds of ambitions that he had. And so he, against his parents' wishes, changed his name to George Washington DeLong.
He was very much in love with his wife. That was the one hard thing, was to be away from her on all these voyages that he did.
Yeah, I was constantly away. That was the life of a naval officer. But he knew this expedition was going to be a really long time because they planned to be away for at least 2 to 4 years. They had enough food for 3 years easily. And so he said goodbye very reluctantly to his wife in San Francisco. Emma DeLong is a major character in the book. And one of the reasons why she is that early on in my research, I had this experience that historians dream about, but it rarely happens, which is, make contact with a relative. In this case, it was a woman named Catherine DeLong, a distant relative of George DeLong in Connecticut. And she said, you know, I have these yellowed letters, these old letters in a trunk in the attic, and I don't know what to do with them. I'm really thinking of throwing them away. Would you please come and look at them? And of course, I flew to Connecticut immediately, checked them out, and they were the personal papers of Emma DeLong, the commander's wife, and lots of things, photos and a manuscript, and mainly, though, this correspondence, during their courtship days and on into the time of the expedition, when she wrote these letters that she called her letters to nowhere, and she would send them north via whaling ships, in the hope that somehow, some way, they would reach him in the Arctic. And they're just absolutely beautiful, heart-wrenching letters. They're, people wrote better back then. That's to start with that. But as the expedition goes from bad to worse, they're really beautiful and, haunting letters. And so they become a big part of the kind of the emotional spine of the book, if you will.
It's just really hard to think about what that would be like. They're each writing to one another with the knowledge that the letters may never get to their destination.
Right.
And yet they seem to have this need to continue talking to one another.
Yeah. Well, it is a love story. I mean, I've written all these kind of He-Man adventure stories now. I've written about the Bataan Death March in World War II and Kit Carson and his role of the conquest of the West, and never really thought I would write a love story. This is very much an adventure story, but kind of cutting right through it is this, I think, really beautiful love story that is made possible by finding these letters, which it was just a cult, you know, godsend. And the understanding with the letters was I would organize the material and then ultimately give it to the Navy Archive at Annapolis. So it's not like I'm holding on to these forever. I was trying to do her a favor and do history a favor at the same time.
So I'm sure a lot of explorers would have liked to have the backing of a guy like James Gordon Bennett. How did he and DeLong come together and come to agree on bringing the Navy and Bennett's money to bear in the same project?
Well, it's a really interesting and really unorthodox arrangement. You can imagine today something like Ted Turner joining forces with NASA to, you know, send a probe to Mars or something like that. It just wouldn't happen. It just is not the kind of – it's highly unorthodox, let's say. But back then, the Navy was extremely weak and very much in its infancy. And they had ambitious young men, and they knew how to sail, but they really did not have a lot of wherewithal to plan an expedition of this magnitude. So Bennett, whose paper had always been very pro-Navy, and who had himself a lot of ties in the Navy and sort of sailing community because he was himself a very good sailor, this, you know, seemingly unorthodox arrangement begins to make more sense. And it also speaks to just how powerful newspapers were back then. You know, it's like if a tree falls in the woods kind of thing. Like if it doesn't have a newspaper reporter on board, this expedition didn't happen kind of thing. And in fact, there wasn't a correspondent from the Herald on board this expedition who was going to, you know, write the account along with DeLong's account. So, you know, this was all kind of, you might say, a newspaper stunt that was also done in the name of science and exploration and for the U.S. Navy all at the same time.
So DeLong really took his time getting ready. He did not race to take off. What does it take to provision a ship of that era to even hope to withstand the conditions of the polar region?
Well, he planned this thing over a period of about 5 years, and he was very thorough. He's very meticulous. He read everything he could get his hands on about the Arctic. He met with all the Arctic exploration sort of gurus and theorists and planned this route very slowly and carefully, this notion of going through the Bering Strait, which had never been tried before. There was a lot of curiosity about that part of the world. We had just fairly recently purchased Alaska from the Russians. People wanted to know what's north of our new territory. And this idea of a current from the Pacific sweeping up through there, softening up the ice, leading to the open polar sea was a compelling one. So all of this took time to kind of absorb and digest and plan and then provision the boat. They knew they would be gone at least 3 years and to massively reinforce its hull for the ice. Because they knew that although they hoped to reach this open polar sea idea, they knew they would encounter ice and had to be prepared for these enormous pressures that they would find in the Arctic. So this was done at a naval yard in San Francisco, and you know, a lot of money and time and effort was spent getting the hull of the ship kind of rebuilt.
My guest is author Hampton Sides. His new book is called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. He's in town to speak tonight at 7 at Highland Park United Methodist Church as part of the Authors Live event that's taking place. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Hampton Sides about his new book, In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So what does one take to be ready for at least 3 years in the Arctic?
Well, DeLong wanted to have all the latest inventions he could find to make this experience go as smoothly as possible. So they had Edison's lights on board. Edison had just been tinkering with his lights. They unfortunately were not perfected yet. But the idea was DeLong would take them up, and during the long polar night where it's dark 24/7, they'd be able to light up the North Pole. And, you know, it's the latest technology, basically. He also brought Alexander Graham Bell's telephones, which the concept was that they would be spread out. Various expeditions would leave the ship, and they'd be able to communicate over the ice over long distances. They had lots of food. They had an organ, so they could have musicals and various entertainments. They had an amazing library. You know, this was the Gilded Age. They didn't want to suffer as they sailed to the North Pole. They wanted to enjoy themselves as much as they could. Unfortunately, they didn't find this what they called thermometric gateway, this warm water current leading through the ice. They promptly got stuck in the ice in September of that year, 1879, and began to drift in the ice pack. And they drifted for 2 years, 1,000 miles, generally heading in the right direction towards the North Pole. And these 2 years, they didn't exactly suffer. They were stuck in the ice. They were constantly worried that the ship might sink because of the pressure against the hull. But they had plenty to eat. They had plenty to do. They took hourly measurements on the ice of all the weather conditions and ice conditions. They exercised on the ice. They played football games. They hunted for polar bear and other marine animals. They had a good time. The only bad thing about that 2 year period was that there was this one guy named Collins, the meteorologist, who had a bad propensity for puns and, you know, just wordplay and limericks and especially bad puns. And this drove the guys absolutely crazy. And after after a few years with this, everyone wanted to kill him, as you can imagine.
It's funny to think that multiple people refer to this and how much it's driving them crazy in their letters and their diaries.
Yeah, they want to lock him up in his room and, you know, shut him up in some way. But you know, it's just an illustration of what 2 years can do in terms of enforced togetherness and over-familiarity and boredom, I guess you'd say. So they'd heard his full, you know, repertoire of puns, and it just drove people crazy.
So it is, you know, a pretty great feat of management to keep everybody basically functional for those 2 years that they were stuck in the pack of ice. Can you talk about specifically some of the ways that DeLong managed conflict and how he kept everybody obedient?
Yeah. Well, this is in many ways a story of leadership and teamwork and how you keep together something that could very easily unravel. The history of polar exploration is littered with stories of mutinies and, you know, worse, cannibalism and so forth. And DeLong had read all the accounts that he could about what happens in the Arctic. So he was very aware that mutiny was just around the corner. He was a stern disciplinarian, old school in that way. And that's why it was one of the main reasons it was a naval expedition. They needed to have that naval discipline because some of the prior expeditions to the North Pole had not really had that. And there was no one in charge. And they very quickly disintegrated. He was adamant about things like every day everyone had to get out on the ice and exercise for, you know, at least two or 3 hours. He was adamant that they have a lot of entertainments and things to do at night. There were musicals, there were songs, there were, you know, plays that were performed. There were feast days where they would have amazing, you know, they didn't eat particularly well normally, but during the feast day, around the holidays, they would eat like kings, you know. And so These were all things that he did to kind of keep up the morale during this long period of 2 years where they were drifting. And what's so frustrating about that is that they just had no control whatsoever. They were just essentially moving with the ice, sometimes backwards, sometimes sideways, sometimes forward, constantly at the mercy of these huge forces that were slowly but surely throttling the ship and crushing the hull.
And this was a wooden ship, we should be clear. It was reinforced, but it was all wood. Right,
right. A wooden ship that had been built from, almost rebuilt from the inside out to withstand the pressure. And it, you know, all the things that they did to the ship clearly helped enormously. The thing lasted for 2 years. A lot of these ships, these Arctic whaling vessels, would get trapped in the ice and immediately sink. So what they did worked. It just eventually succumbed to the forces of the ice.
So there are multiple ironic notes in this story, one of which is that, like, very soon after the time that they realized that Edison's light bulbs weren't going to work, Edison was having this epiphany and perfecting the filaments that went in light bulbs.
Right, right, right. Within 2 months of their leaving San Francisco, he was perfecting the light bulb. And, you know, that would have made a huge difference in terms of morale. There were also a series of scientists who were coming back from the Pacific, having studied these currents up there, trying to figure out how strong were they? Did they, in fact, go through the Bering Strait, and to what extent? And they were bringing this data home to Washington, D.C., the United States Geodetic Survey. And what they found was that the current wasn't strong enough to create a gateway that, you know, the ideas on which this expedition were predicated were suspect at best. And, you know, I mean, it's sort of the nature of tragedy that there's all these little instances of bad timing or missteps or near misses. And that's sort of what this story becomes, is an accumulation of these what-ifs, these tiny little almost situations like that. If they had known this, they probably would have abandoned the expedition and gone towards the North Pole in some other way.
So grand irony number two, after 2 years of being stuck in the ice, they are free, but not for very long.
Yeah, Jeanette becomes disentangled from the ice and sails, is in water, is floating. Everyone's looking at it and thinking, well, we're okay. This is going to be great, because there was great fear that it might not actually be able to float once it was released from the ice. But within a day, it sank. It just went straight to the bottom and had very little time to react, to get things out on the ice. DeLong had a plan that he had thought about for many months of which objects, which pieces of equipment, what did they really need to get out on the ice. There were three whaling vessels, whale open boats. There were, you know, a certain amount of food they had to get out, some instruments, and then the logbooks that they had been working on for the whole two-year period, all the measurements and all the things that were sort of proof that the expedition had actually been there. And they became almost relics to DeLong. He really wanted to make sure, no matter how heavy they were, that they would come with him everywhere he went. So there would be a record of this expedition eventually, no matter what happened.
So how much food were they able to offload?
Not enough. Not nearly enough. They were able to get a lot of the hardtack and the stuff called pemmican, which is kind of like jerky. It's mixed in with fat and berries, and it's nutritious stuff. It keeps, but it's not very tasty, and it kind of drove the men crazy. So as they are out on the ice, marooned, these 33 men and their 40 dogs, trying to figure out where to go, they realize that they're going to have to do a lot of hunting as they go to supplement their diet with polar bear and walrus and seal. They head south towards the nearest landmass, which is the central coast of Siberia, and it's about 1,000 miles away. So they start, you know, dragging all the stuff across the ice. And I think some people have a misconception that the ice up there is, you know, it's kind of smooth. It's a big slab of ice. You can skate across it or something like that. But it's pressure ridges. It's pools of melt water. It's all these holes that you're constantly falling in. There's constant danger that you're going to lose somebody, some member of the crew. There is no clear route, you know. And as you're moving south, DeLong found, he was often actually moving backwards because the ice itself was drifting faster toward the north than he was moving south.
Let's be clear. They're still on ice. They're not on land. They're still on an ice floe.
They're on an ice. They're on, again, it's sort of like the ice pack is constantly churning, constantly moving, constantly alive. It's warring with itself constantly. And so it's like it's never safe. You know, you're constantly on edge. And it's just so remarkable that he was able, DeLong, to keep these men together for this great trek across the ice, nearly 1,000 miles, till they finally did reach open water and put these whale boats into the water to set sail for Siberia.
It's awful to think about Siberia being like your greatest hope. Like that seems like a place that everybody associates with really desolate, almost unlivable conditions, and this was their great hope.
Right. I mean, they were making for this hopeless place that was 400 miles above the Arctic Circle in the permafrost, where nothing grows. And this was their hope that they would somehow reach this place. It was called the Lena Delta. It's the delta of the Lena River, which is one of the biggest rivers in the world. And that there would be villagers, there would be natives that would take them in and save them. So this was what they were shooting for. And they knew it was one of the great retreats across the ice, you know, of all time. This was one of the great feats of survival. If they could make it, this would it would be a miracle.
What kind of insight did they get? There were two native Inuit members of the crew. How helpful were they in navigating?
Extremely, extremely. Not so much navigating, but hunting. They were really good hunters, and they were really never in want of a polar bear. They ate a lot of polar bear on this trip, and which means that they didn't eat their dogs, which is, you know, another way in which this story is very different from most of the polar stories. It seems like they're always eating their dogs. And in the end, it's not particularly good for the dogs. I think the SPCA probably won't like this book particularly, but it was not part of DeLong's plan to butcher his own dogs, and he was quite adamant about that.
What do you read between the lines as you look at all these journals and accounts that the men kept in terms of like how their moods were and how they changed as things grew more dire?
Mm. Well, fortunately, there are a lot of accounts that were written, both journals and the survivors gave testimony and were the subject of all these articles and best-selling books and from the 1880s. So there's a lot of raw material to work with. And, you know, I think that that's a big theme throughout this story is just how they kept their spirits up. You know, during this march across to the south, you'd be surprised in the first few weeks anyway, their morale was extremely high because for the first time they were not at the mercy of these other forces. They were doing something to save themselves. Mm-hmm. And they organized themselves in these squads that kind of competed against each other in a friendly sort of way. DeLong was very, very good about trying to figure out a way to organize this thing so it would work. So, you know, you'd be surprised. During that first part of the retreat, everyone writes in their journal very positive things, even though it was like the hardest possible work, the hardest possible slogging you could imagine over this expanse of rubble and slush and, you know, falling in all the time, wet all the time. They're actually in high spirits, singing songs, and, you know, it's almost like they feel like they're heading home. To their wives and their girlfriends and their mothers and to their homeland. But really where they're heading for is this extremely, as we say, desolate place in the middle of nowhere in the central coast of Siberia.
How do the boats get separated?
Well, they get in the water and they start they have to actually repair the boats significantly because this great, you know, dragging across the ice has completely destroyed the boats. So they have to improvise a little bit and figure out a way to make them seaworthy. But then they get in the water and they head south. But along the way, by the way, they discover a number of islands and explore them and claim them for the United States. These islands are called to this day the DeLong Islands, north of Russia. But they're part of Russia now. But on the second day in the water, they encounter a gale, a massive gale, which separates the boats, scatters them from each other. And so the story really becomes the story of the very different fates of these three boats and the men in them, because they make landfall at very different places along the coast of Siberia.
Not knowing for a very long time the fates of the others.
Exactly. And so each storyline is really this sense of not knowing, you know, where their comrades are, if their comrades are even alive. And so they're trying to save themselves, but they're also trying to find each other.
How did a separate ship called the Corwin come to be dispatched to at least keep an eye out for the Jeannette?
Well, as often happens in these Arctic stories, things don't go well. And then after a few years, people begin to be worried back home. And so they send ships out to look for them. And the Corwin was one of those ships. It was sent from San Francisco in the summer of 1881 to look for the Jeannette and to go back up through the Bering Strait and head that general way and just look for any tidings of DeLong and his men. Gordon Bennett paid for much of this, and it was an interesting vessel that had aboard the ship a young naturalist and newspaper reporter, the great John Muir, who later became the founder of the Sierra Club. Muir was interested in glaciers. He wanted to go to the high Arctic, and he wanted to write stories for the papers about their adventures. So he wrote beautifully about it in a book that was published posthumously called The Cruise of the Corwin. And he becomes a major character, John Muir, in the last, say, third of the book as they're really, it's a big detective story. They're in the high Arctic, calling it these islands and along the coastline, just trying to find some sign of DeLong and his men.
We're speaking this hour with author Hampton Sides. His new book is called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. He's in town to speak tonight at 7 at Highland Park United Methodist Church. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Hampton Sides about his new book, In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Jim in McKinney. Hello, Jim.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. It's fascinating. My curiosity is whether or not there was any expression of fear in the research that was done.
In expression among the men of what they were going into? Yes. I mean, I think they all understood that this was a very dangerous expedition and they may not come home. And that made me realize what a difference there is between that generation and today. Because although I think we still have the polar, you know, fascination with exploration and we're willing to take certain risks. But George DeLong got thousands of applications for this from all over the country, from all over the world. People wanted to be aboard this ship, knowing full well that this was an expedition virtually guaranteed to produce hardship, if not death. But this is it was a different time. It was a different generation. These were men who had just come after the Civil War. And I think there was a little bit of a chip on their shoulder of like wanting to do something big and take risks in the name of their country in some way. And so that was part of it. And just they were just tougher. And there was a stoicism about life and death that I think we don't have as much today. So fear, not exactly. When things really go bad and they write in their journals that they realize they might die, they start writing these very beautiful letters to their loved ones back home. It's not exactly fear, though. It's a kind of a nobility, a kind of a resignation that the Lord gives and takes away, and this is just the way it is. So I think we're just a lot softer, I think, than those guys, for sure.
Well, I guess, you know, living back then, you know, people were dying of infectious disease and things that we could easily cure today. And, you know, people worked in dangerous occupations. And maybe given that, you know, today you're born and you sort of hope and expect to live to be, you know, in your 80s, mm-hmm. you couldn't expect that back then. So maybe you wanted to use every minute.
Life expectancy was low. And also the Navy, which many of these guys, including all the officers, were Navy guys. It was an extremely dangerous profession. They were constantly getting into trouble and dying. So it was just kind of part and parcel of existence was to really accept the risk factor of these kinds of expeditions. So fear, I'm sure they were scared, but they certainly didn't let on in their journals much. It's, you know, that stiff upper lip kind of thing maybe we inherited from the Brits in terms of polar exploration.
We haven't talked yet about John Melville, who is another really who's another really fascinating character and someone that I very much came to admire reading mm-hmm. this book.
Well, Melville was the engineer on board, and when anything ever went wrong, which it did, just about everything you can imagine, Melville is called upon to invent some solution. The ship starts to sink, is flooded in its hold, and so he develops this network of windmills that brings the water up from...
It's like MacGyver.
You just call Melville. He'll make it work. And pretty much was the case. He tried to make Edison's lights work, almost made it happen, but they just weren't ready for prime time yet. Mm-hmm. But he also emerges in the last third of the story as really one of the lead, if not the lead character, because he has to go back into the Leyden Delta in winter to try to find his lost comrades and leads this amazing search through the labyrinth of the Leyden Delta to find DeLong and his men. And he just doesn't let go. He also happens to be a really good writer, and he wrote a best-selling book in the 1880s that is a wonderful document and something that I use a lot and quote from. So you need characters like Melville. He's supposedly distantly related to Herman Melville and tough as nails, and went on to become the chief engineer of the entire U.S. Navy and presided over its evolution from a mostly wooden ship navy to a metal ship navy. So really interesting guy with an interesting career.
Was there criticism back home of Bennett's choice to be so heavily involved in this thing that, you know, to say the very least, did not turn out the way everyone had hoped?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a little of that, although when the survivors of the Jeannette came home, they were welcomed as heroes. There were parades in Manhattan. They were the subject of best-selling books. Yes, there was a naval inquiry that tried to look into what went wrong and was Bennett somehow responsible for this. Bennett himself, true to his word, paid for everything. And that was never really questioned. You know, he just wrote the checks. And he also capitalized off of this in the sense that his newspaper published endless stories. This ended up being a bigger sensation for his paper than Stanley Livingston, because not only did the Jeannette have its problems, but all these other ships that were sent north had their own adventures and problems. And it was like a gift that kept giving. Just, you know, the story kept repeating itself in the Arctic. You know, Bennett was helpful to, you know, all the widows of those who died and remained steadfast in terms of, you know, paying for everything.
So these were not your first trips to the Arctic when you were researching this book, mm-hmm. were they?
Well, yes, my first trip to the Arctic. But yeah, I did a series of stories. I did a piece for National Geographic about a place called Wrangel Island, which is off the northeast coast of Siberia. It's way up there. And this was a place that John Muir and his guys had made the first landfall on and had claimed for the United States. It's now the largest denning ground for polar bear. It's believed to be the last place on Earth where woolly mammoths lived. It's a highly restricted Russian preserve. There's four guys that live there. When we visited, they were just so happy to see us, just so happy to see human beings instead of polar bear. It's an amazing place. And, you know, just to get some sense, when I'm doing these books, I like to get some sense of what this topography looks like and what the weather is like. It just enters into the narrative in all kinds of ways. So then I went to the Landan Delta in the middle of Siberia, which took about 12 different permits to get to, and a lot of vodka and cigarettes and other means of bribing my way onto a riverboat, which went into the Delta, deep into the Delta, and got me to the place where there is still, after all these years, a memorial to the men of the Jeannette. It's called America Mountain, in the middle of nowhere, in the permafrost of northern Siberia. So,
you alluded to this earlier, but it comes up in the book. People can imagine what the world is like on a snowy day, even here in North Texas. We've had some of those. Sound travels differently. Mentioned in the Arctic. Can you explain that?
Well, sometimes it feels and sounds like you're under a dome. The atmosphere is so close, it's so foggy, and the sound travels strangely over the ice. And sometimes there'll be some noise that's really far away that sounds like it's really close, and everything is at the same time kind of muffled. And DeLong writes beautifully about this, about sound and how eerie and haunting and at the same time beautiful it is when he goes out on his nightly walks in the middle of the winter and watches the midnight, northern lights. And it's just something that a lot of these people had been to the Arctic before and they want to keep going back. It gets in your blood, you know, the polar virus, they called it. And DeLong was certainly one of them. He just couldn't get enough of the place.
Can you describe what the ice looked like, and were there things that took you by surprise when you saw it that helped you to understand some of the accounts that you read?
Well, one of the things that I had a misconception that the ice pack was more or less this sort of monolithic thing, this constant thing. You're either on it or you're off of it, you know. But instead, you know, what you see is that it's alive. It's moving. It's constantly changing. It's constantly fighting itself. There's all these crevices and pressure ridges. There's old ice and there's new ice. There's, you know, freshwater ice, saltwater ice. It's this living, breathing phenomenon out there. And obviously not the kind of terrain you want to be moving over if you have to be dragging boats and so forth. But if you're smashing through it in a Russian icebreaker, which I was, it's just fascinating to watch and listen to. It's constantly, you know, sending up this terrific racket of shuddering and shaking and shrieking sometimes. So it just feels like it's a living, breathing presence.
What is your experience of cold when you're in a place like that?
Well, I was there in August, so it wasn't that cold, but I mean, it was in the 20s, mm-hmm. So I can imagine what it's like in the middle of winter where you get temperatures around 70 below zero Fahrenheit, things like that. It's a constant force these men had to deal with. You know, they were cold the whole time. They had furs. They had a lot of coal on board, which they burned very carefully because they knew it had to last them for the whole experience. Cold is a constant companion in this story, and maybe it'll cool things off here in Dallas. It's been pretty hot lately, and you know, it's like one of the reviewers said it was literary air conditioning to read this book.
It's true. It is refreshing, and it makes you not want to complain about the heat here.
Yeah.
Do you think? I mean, is this the kind of story that, you know, teenage boys were reading in the 1880s and thinking, okay, I'm going to be the one that actually does this.
Yes. I think that's kind of what this was, you know, this was the early days of polar fever. And whereas most people would read these Arctic tales and say they were cautionary tales, like, okay, well, I won't do that. That's one thing I will avoid.
Right.
There's a certain kind of person out there who would read these stories and say, no, I'm going to do that, but I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to, you know, make these little refinements to the expedition and lead my own. And of course, we did reach the North Pole first with Perry, and it was in 1909. And, you know, although that is somewhat disputed now exactly if he reached the precise location. So, yeah, there was this whole generation of people who decided, you know, we're going to be the nation to do it. We're going to do it for personal glory, for national glory, and for science.
And, of course, now there are real concerns that there may not be ice at the pole. It's strange that this was their undoing 100-and-something years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real deep irony to me that DeLong set off in search of an open polar sea, didn't exist, but now we are told that at least in summertime, there will probably be an open polar sea for you know, July, August, or whatever, within the next 50 years. So it's somewhat scary and quite ironic. And, you know, I think you can say that DeLong was crazy or quixotic, or you could just say that he was a victim of bad timing. Because this is something that, you know, the more the climate folks study this, and interestingly, they've been taking DeLong's journals and logbooks, all these measurements that were taken of the ice, digitizing, analyzing them, and they've provided a really good measurement of what the ice pack looked like 135 years ago, which was something we were missing. It's all sort of speculation how quickly the ice has been changing in that part of the world. Now we know, and it's quite eye-opening. It's in some places as much as 70%. It's diminished by 70% in this part of the Arctic. So it's scary and interesting time to kind of revisit this tale from the Gilded Age.
Were there provisions they sacrificed so that they could have those logbooks?
Yes. One of the main things is photographs. I think that one of the reasons people haven't heard of the Jeannette expedition is that there are no photographs. They all went down with the ship. They were really heavy, all that equipment and all the plates, the glass plates. And so they made a decision that they, you know, those are going to the bottom of the ocean. And that's where they lie today, along with Edison's network of lights and Graham Bell's telephones and all the other inventions that were on board. You know, anything that weighed a lot that wasn't providing sustenance or calories or something eventually got jettisoned. No mementos. No one was really allowed to carry anything else. But those logbooks went all the way across the ice, across the open water, across the tundra, and ended up eventually in St. Petersburg and then finally National Archives in Washington.
And then in this book?
And then in this book.
Hampton Sides' new book is called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. He's in town to speak tonight at 7 at Highland Park United Methodist Church. Hampton, thank you so much for making time to be here.
Great to be here.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.